Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Joining us on the program today is Jamie Butler, coordinator of the Great Salt Lake Institute at Westminster College. She is directing a youth summer camp for high school students, July 15th through July 21st. Jamie adds that scholarships are also available for students to help cover the camp fee.
The overall goal is to lead to some overall stewardship of Great Salt Lake by the people that we work with. Right now, we're really excited to be offering a high school summer camp for students ages 15 to 18. It's called Camp Great Salt Lake. It's a residence camp here at Westminster College where these high school students come up here and experience college life. They experience what it's like to be a scientist for a week. And we do a lot of, you know, fun field collections and lab work. And the students also have a really fun opportunity to work with our college students who are doing their summer research right now. And one of the fun things we're doing is we're also inviting high school teachers, middle school teachers, and even elementary school teachers. We have 5 spots, and we would compensate them for their help and time at Camp Great Salt Lake, and we'll also give them resources on how to use Great Salt Lake in their classroom with all of their future students.
Jamie adds that scholarships are also available for students to help cover the camp fee.
We love to spend a lot of time out at Great Salt Lake. So a good third of the camp is going to be outside playing around in the water. We do use stand-up paddle boards to collect samples sometimes, which is really fun. We'll be out visiting Spiral Jetty one day and looking at some land art, very famous land art in the north arm of Great Salt Lake. We have different researchers around the lake that we're going to go visit sample sites and collection sites and see what they're doing. It depends on the day. You know, one day you'll go out and collect samples on the stand-up paddle boards, and that's an adventure in its own, you know, collecting samples and taking a look at the water in different parts of the lake. But then you bring your samples back to the lab and start looking at them under a microscope, and that turns into the coolest thing that you've ever seen. And there's just so many different experiences that they'll experience along the way. And it's pretty cool to be living away from your parents. Don't tell parents this, but it's pretty cool to be living in a college dorm and be able to play in the gym here at Westminster. There's a climbing wall and a pool that they'll have access to.
Jamie says one major goal of the workshop is to bring more attention to Great Salt Lake and its fragile and fascinating ecosystem that is often thought of as dead.
There's this preconception of nothing lives in Great Salt Lake. It's stinky, there's too many bugs, there's, you know, these kind of negative perceptions that when you take a student out there, or take anybody out to Great Salt Lake and give them some firsthand knowledge on really what lives out there and how it's important, you really start to see some changes in their perceptions, and oftentimes they are very surprised at how cool, how beautiful the lake is, and how much really lives in Great Salt Lake, and what it means to everybody in Utah. So a lot of the camp is geared towards even just very simple understanding of what lives out there, the brine shrimp and the brine flies, and how, you know, over 7 million birds migrate here every year to feed, reproduce, and rest on Great Salt Lake. But there's also some human impacts. You know, there's invasive species like Phragmites that have been introduced to Utah that cause problems in and around Great Salt Lake. There's industries that will visit and see how they remediate land and how they treat the land. So really, it's a very broad and general understanding of what lives in the lake and why it's important to every person in the state of Utah and in the world.
Jamie grew up in Salt Lake City and says she had the same preconceptions as most other residents.
When I started working out there as a biologist about 15 years ago, I started to get to know the lake and what was in there and saw the changing seasons and the beautiful sunsets and started to learn about, you know, all of the birds that live out there and got to know the people who worked on the lake and who relied on the lake for their help and for their jobs. And just, you know, it was this culmination of all of these years of working out there and seeing just how it all kind of works together.
The Great Salt Lake Youth Camp runs July 15 through July 21st. For more information, visit greatsaltlakeinstitute.org. Switching from the lake to the sky, a team of engineering students from Utah State University launched their student-built spacecraft a mile into the air and won their fourth national NASA rocket competition. They competed against 40 other colleges and universities in April at the NASA University Student Launch Initiative in Alabama. The USU rocket, named the Sturgeon, won Best Overall Vehicle Design. USU mechanical engineer Dr. Stephen Tony Whitmore presents the good news.
It's actually kind of intriguing. It's four times in the last 5 years we've done that now. And the competition is really heating up. It's become quite a big national thing, and a lot of people scratch their heads and say, Utah State, who? How are they winning this over the likes of MIT and Vanderbilt? But we have good student effort, and that really helps. So, yeah, we're building quite a dynasty, but let me tell you, it's not easy. We teach this as a one-year-long senior design class, and students, they have to sweat blood to do this. This is real. This isn't theoretical. When that rocket disappears into the sky, if there's not much you can do about it at that point. So we spend a lot of time going through the same processes that NASA would use when they launch one of their big rockets.
Dr. Whitmore says they have probably won so many times because the students put their heart and soul into their rocket and the competition.
We have a senior design capstone requirement for all of the students in our departmental program here. And the students can pick and choose some of their projects, and this is one that we offer to actually design this rocket as a part of the competition. And it's glamorous enough, but it's just hard enough that we sort of are able to pick and choose the students that we want to do this. And so generally, the students that commit to doing this have kind of got aerospace and wanting to work in this industry in their blood. So they put quite a bit of effort into that, and I think that makes a big difference. I'd like to hopefully think that I had a little bit to do with it. In some ways, I actually worked for NASA for 25 years and had been on many of NASA reviews and various design cycles. And so I tried to bring some of the management and project organization techniques that I learned from NASA and bring it to this project. And I think that really helps out, because part of the competition in winning this is that we have to go through a whole series of design reviews, peer reviews with NASA professionals on the other end that we're making briefings and presentations to. And we try to very professionally structure our presentations to make them look exactly like what a NASA briefing would. And I think that's really helped our scores a lot.
The main role of the competition is to reach as close to a mile high as possible. And that is the tricky part.
It's a lot easier to build a big dumb rocket that goes very high than it is to build a very sophisticated rocket. And so to do this, the students have to bring in a lot of very sophisticated avionics and guidance systems to be able to make this rocket do it, because you got to understand, when this thing launches, it simply disappears up into the sky, and being able to hit a target altitude within 50 or 100 feet is really a difficult task. And so we designed a system that actually tried to using sensors on board to know exactly what its altitude, velocity, and energy state was, and then we designed systems that would either introduce drag or extra thrust along the way to basically track along a profile to put it within very close to the 1 mile target altitude, and I think we were about 100 feet high this year, which sounds like a lot, but when you really think of the distance over which that thing's going, that's actually a pretty good hit. Students were a little disappointed. We were trying to get closer to that, but it was still good enough to win the competition.
The team, comprised of 13 students, made sure the rocket went fast. It soared up to roughly 350 miles an hour, and it had a safe landing. The rules of the competition require it land within a mile and a half of the launch pad.
We also have to carry a scientific payload, and what our payload was essentially a system to measure and manage the energy level, and we designed a set of really unique thrusters to do that. And that's sort of a cold sheet design. So the students get to be very creative in that what I try to do in the class is I say, look, these are the things that we need to do to actually accomplish that. And then the students go out and spend a lot of time actually designing the hardware, the concepts that would actually do that. And then when the rubber meets the road, they've got to actually make all these systems work and play nice together. And that's the hard part. They learn that then because they don't get to see that in an academic environment, that making things work and making things integrate, it's a stressful task, and you can really see the strain on their face by the end of the year.
Their four straight wins have helped propel USU's aerospace program.
Two of my students who are on the rocket team are down today in Chandler, Arizona, interviewing at Orbital Sciences Corporation, working on their program for their commercial option for transportation of the station. They've got a rocket that's going to do very similar to what SpaceX just did, delivering commercial cargo services up to International Space Station. So hopefully they'll come back with some good news tomorrow that they've gotten a job at Orbital. But yeah, the students are passionate about getting a chance to work within the aerospace organization.
Dr. Whitmore says it is one of the best in the Intermountain West.
Stan Albrecht, president of the university, he's aggressively tried to make Utah State a very competitive research institution by going after commercial partnerships and so forth, and that's really helped a lot. The other thing that we have an advantage that a lot of people don't understand is the Space Dynamics Laboratory here in Logan is actually a federally funded research laboratory. It's called a university-affiliated federally funded research laboratory, but they're actually a subsidiary of Utah State. They're part of the Utah State Research Foundation, and so we have a huge supply of intellectual capital we can rely on over at Space Dynamics Lab to help that. And SDL supports our project, and we get a lot of help and guidance from some of the professionals over there. And so they sort of give us a critical mass that a lot of the other universities don't actually have in this area. So that helps us quite a bit.
And how challenging and rewarding is it for you to work with these students and these teams that are building rockets?
I'll tell you what, we crashed a rocket. One of our first early tests back in February, we had a malfunction on a system that we didn't understand until after it happened. And it just about wore me out this year. I mean, trying to recover from crashing a rocket, by the end of May, I was pretty tired. So it's challenging. There's no doubt about it. There's a lot of midnights and one in the morning trying to get stuff to go. But the rewarding part is watching these students, watching the light bulbs go on. Because for the first 3 years of their academic career, they've just been taking tests and regurgitating information. And now suddenly they've got to build this stuff and make it work. And it's like, guys, I can't do this for you. You have to do this yourself. And then to watch them go and fight with a particular component or an integration until it actually works. And then when they figure it out, watching the light bulbs go on, that's really the best part of it. When they get out of our program after completing their design class, they're battle-tested. They're ready to go into industry and contribute right away.
Sherry Quinn, Access Utah. Coming up next, Science Questions profiles the book called The Last Tortoise with author Craig Stanford.
Thank you. Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. This week, learn how more than 26,000 Utah school children helped purchase the silver service used on the American battleship USS Utah. First this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
$10,000 is a lot of money today. It was even more in 1909, particularly when it was spent to buy a bunch of silver platters and a fancy punch bowl. But that is how much the state of Utah paid for the silver service it presented as a gift to the newly commissioned American battleship USS Utah. In the early 20th century, national tradition deemed that any state with a battleship named after it present the new ship with an elegant silver service. Utah's Governor William Spry wanted the silver service to be a source of pride for all Utah citizens, so he also thought they should have the privilege of helping to pay for it. As part of his public contribution scheme, Governor Spry proposed that Utah school children participate in the funding drive and recommended a contribution of 10 cents each. Heeding the governor's call, 26,477 Utah school children donated a total of $2,277.42 to the Silver Service Fund. By 1910, the purchase was underway. The silver service would consist of 102 pieces and be of high quality and modest design. Its distinguishing feature was its great decorative detail, with individual pieces engraved with depictions of Utah industry, historic events, and natural scenery. One of the pieces, a coffee tray depicting the Brigham Young Monument in downtown Salt Lake City, caused controversy among non-Mormon Utahns. But after months of local and even national debate, the U.S. Navy Department determined that the engravings were acceptable. On November 6, 1911, Governor Spry presented the silver service to Captain William Benson, first commander of the USS Utah, in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. The USS Utah was decommissioned in 1932 and served as a training ship until sunk at Pearl Harbor in 1941. Thankfully, some of these pricey silver pieces were saved and returned to the state of Utah, where they are currently in the custody of the Utah Division of State History. Research and writing for this episode of the Beehive Archive were provided by Heidi Orchard. Sources and past episodes may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
Support for Science Questions is provided by Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com.
Science Questions is made possible by a U.S. Department of Labor grant from the Utah Governor's Office of Economic Development and the Utah Department of Workforce Services.
Un, deux, trois.
Science Questions!
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn. Tortoises are edging closer towards extinction every day. There are 50 species of tortoises, and today many of them are endangered. They are land-dwelling turtles, able to occupy most of the Earth's harshest terrain, from dense rainforests to parched, sandy deserts. Their glorious bony shell provides protection from predators, male competitors, and elements such as rain and the hot sun. Their clever old evolutionary suit and their modern zen-like behavior makes them even more vulnerable to human predation, the worst marauder of turtles and tortoises. Craig Stanford, author of The Last Tortoise, A Tale of Extinction in Our Lifetime, is professor of anthropology and biological sciences at the University of Southern California, where he is also director of the Jane Goodall Research Center. He has published numerous scientific papers and books about apes and monkeys. He recently took time out to tell the alarming story of the quiet, noble creature, the tortoise.
I actually was inspired to write the book because of a trip to Myanmar, where I was actually attempting to begin research on a completely unrelated animal behavior area, and I just was exposed firsthand to the ongoing tragedy of what's happening to tortoises in the world today.
And what happened in Myanmar?
Well, I was escorted around Myanmar by a biologist colleague who was a tortoise biologist and who was an expert on tortoises in Myanmar, and I got to see firsthand some of the issues and problems affecting tortoises, such as truckloads of turtles and tortoises being shipped to the Chinese border, where they would be smuggled across the border into China and make their way to the food markets. And we're talking about thousands and thousands per day. So the scale of the problem was enormous. And I visited sanctuaries in which tortoises that had been confiscated by the authorities were being placed, and there were just hundreds and hundreds piled up with no real future, I would assume, but the police, having confiscated them, didn't know exactly what to do with them. So I really saw the scale firsthand.
What were they using the tortoises for, food and medicine?
Yeah, in Asia, tortoises and turtles are on the menu in a very big way. Turtles, in particular, are a delicacy in Chinese culture. Many, many species are being farm-raised today in China. And if you go into a market in Beijing or Shanghai, you'll see thousands of turtles that are being bred for consumption. But the tortoise issue is different. Tortoises are not very easily raised in captivity because they reproduce and grow very slowly, and they're just collected from the wild, and then they make their way to the food markets to be eaten.
And how much revenue a year are they bringing into these countries?
The revenue involved in the tortoise and turtle trade simply for the food markets is in the tens of millions of dollars per year. And the number of tortoises and turtles that are taken from the wild every year is a staggering number. You have a hard time imagining that there could still be turtles and tortoises left.
The smallest tortoise can fit in the palm of a hand. They range in size from just a few inches to the nearly half-ton Galapagos giant tortoise that would fill up a Mini Cooper car to the brim. Unlike turtles, tortoises are not aquatic and do not have webbed feet. They also do not have the ability to reproduce fast enough to withstand the rapid harvesting currently happening in Asia and around the world.
The entire continent of Southeast Asia, meaning Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, Myanmar, Laos, has been vacuumed, essentially, of its turtle and tortoise fauna and taken into China to serve the food markets and the burgeoning middle class that can now afford to buy delicacy foods that they could not afford to buy in earlier times. So really, China is the villain in terms of the Asian picture. And in fact, not only food, but even pets are beginning to interest the Chinese, who are in greater and greater numbers and greater dollars beginning to look for exotic tortoises and turtles to keep as pets. And that also is a big problem.
Why would you tell somebody not to, in North America, not to have a tortoise pet?
Well, I mean, tortoises are adorable animals. I find them absolutely unique, fascinating, and wonderful. The fact is that an animal that lives so long and can be demanding in its care isn't the best pet unless you're really equipped and prepared to make that kind of a commitment. And if you walk into a pet store, unfortunately, although there are tortoises that are being raised in captivity and sold in the pet trade today, there still are many types of tortoises that are imported, and you can walk into a pet store and see them. They've been imported over the past several weeks from West Africa, from the Amazon basin. They look just fine, but in fact, they're loaded with parasites. They've been taken from the wild, and so there are all sorts of good reasons not to buy them when you see them in pet stores. You can, if you really want a tortoise as a pet, you can look into adopting one. There are lots of adoption agencies. There are rescue centers that are trying to place tortoises in homes, but pet stores are really a bad place to think about buying a tortoise.
And are they brought to North America by the thousands?
They are brought to North America by the thousands, in former decades by the millions. And today there are export quotas for most countries, so that even for those that are legally exported from, let's say, Africa, the numbers are still quite large. And the problem really is that these are animals that they don't necessarily survive very well in captivity. They're reptiles, so they're tough. They survive the journey even when they're stacked like oranges in a box. They survive in a pet store long enough for some innocent consumer to buy them, not realizing that they're filled with parasites and probably won't live more than 6 months or 12 months. And by then, you know, you've lost that part of the gene pool in the wild from a decreasing species.
And what about the rare species that are highly valuable on the black market, and what are the ranges that they can go for?
Well, you know, we humans have a kind of a perverse logic as collectors, which is that when something we cherish becomes more and more scarce, we're willing to pay much more for it, and that makes it much scarcer. So in the case of tortoises, there are tortoises that are critically endangered, down to a few hundred or a few dozen even in the wild, that today will command upwards of $30,000 or $40,000 per tortoise on the global black market. And as I say in the book, there are parts of the world in which the global black market trade in tortoises rivals that of narcotics, which is an incredible statement, I know. But tortoises are just valuable creatures as pets. People are willing to pay $1,000, $2,000 for them routinely, the way you might buy a pedigree dog. And they're willing to buy smuggled tortoises, unfortunately, also, sometimes because the smuggled animals are cheaper.
And what about a tortoise, other than its role in our ecosystem, is worth saving?
Well, you know, I always say that if a biologist from some other galaxy ever came to Earth and collected animals for a menagerie back on his home planet, he would probably be amazed by pandas and elephants and tigers, but he would be astounded by tortoises, because their set of adaptations that have evolved to make them successful on this Earth are absolutely amazing. You know, the shell, that incredible device they've evolved for protection, and then the way their anatomy has been completely torqued to be put inside the shell, and then, of course, their incredible longevity and their amazing fertility, which increases over the course of the lifespan rather than decreases. So all of those things, to me, make a tortoise unique enough and amazing enough to be worth saving in its own right.
And why do they have these amazing shells, and what are their ranges of lifespans and fertility years?
Well, the theoretical lifespan for a tortoise is extremely long. We all know of these stories of tortoises living hundreds of years. Those are mostly apocryphal stories. In fact, the best authenticated maximum age for any tortoise is probably just shy of 200 years old, somewhere between 150 and 180. And that longevity is part of a long-term evolved strategy they have, which is live slow, die slow, and live long enough to lay enough eggs that you can replace yourself. And then, of course, the tragic irony is that they have this wonderful shell that's so protective, but at the same time, in the face of modern man, really doesn't offer them any protection at all, because we collect them, we pick them up, we run over them with our cars. You know, the shell really is no longer good protection for them.
And is it true that they can reproduce even in their last years, and 100 years old?
Well, we know from studies of turtles that females actually can be more fertile when they're 80 years old than when they were 20 and reach sexual maturity. So, yeah, there's this sort of sense of the fountain of age or eternal youth, which is something that we as humans, I'm sure, admire and respect, that these animals actually increase in fertility as they age rather than decrease. Tortoises as a family have roots that go back 200 million or more years, so they're a very long-term successful group on planet Earth. And in fact, if you just went back in a time machine just a couple of thousand years before today, you'd find big tortoises in almost every tropical ecosystem on Earth. They were just big herbivores that lived alongside of antelope and deer and so forth, grazing away. And their whole set of adaptations, the shell, the longevity, are all remarkably successful right up until the time that humans entered their lives. And then, of course, from that moment on, we've progressively wiped them out of essentially every one of their habitats on Earth. The only places on Earth where there are giant tortoises left is, of course, these tiny offshore islands like the Galapagos. Those kinds of large tortoises once occupied just about every continent on Earth, and now they're only left in their very last refuges.
So the tortoise is a slow metaphor for all those fast losing the extinction race.
Well, yes. I mean, I think the tortoise and hare analogy is kind of interesting, because they are animals that have succeeded throughout their evolution by living a slow, steady pace, but ultimately winning out. And now that strategy just doesn't work in the 21st century. They're losing out to the food market in Asia. They're losing out to the pet trade globally. And, of course, they're losing out to what many animals are losing out to, which is the destruction of their habitat.
And which tortoises are most threatened, and is habitat loss the primary culprit there?
Habitat destruction is a big problem for all kinds of wildlife, but tortoises in particular. And, of course, tortoises don't usually have the ability to live in kind of degraded semi-habitat. Once the forest is gone or the habitat is gone, then they're pretty much gone. There are some cases in which tortoises have been reduced, a whole species, to just a few hundred individuals. So, for instance, the plowshare tortoise in Madagascar, which at one time was extremely numerous, extremely abundant. Now there are just a few hundred left. There are many more being bred in captivity. An individual plowshare tortoise can bring $30,000 or $40,000 on the black market. And believe me, there are collectors out there in North America, in Europe, in Japan, who are willing to pay that kind of money just so they can say they have this tortoise in their possession, which to me is awfully perverse, but that's the way that humans think.
And you give an example in Indonesia where the government is sacrificing forests to grow palms for oil, causing rapid deforestation.
Yeah, I mean, all over the third world we have the issue of the competition between development of land and then the needs of wildlife. And so Indonesia, for example, is a place where the government is really strongly encouraging the conversion or the destruction of natural forests, tropical forests, to be turned into plantations, especially palm oil plantations for the production of palm oil for cooking. And that's an area where once the forest is gone, those are extremely diverse forests. You don't just lose the tortoises, you lose thousands and thousands of other species. And conservationists are working hard on these issues. They're working and negotiating with the Indonesian government and with companies there that are producing palm oil and also producing paper and pulp from the trees to try to set some limits and some guidelines. But it's a difficult problem.
You say in your book, the chimps have Jane Goodall, the mountain gorillas Diane Fossey, and tortoises have Peter Pritchard, who has amassed 12,000 skeletons. Can you elaborate on
that? Well, yeah, there are people out there who are extremely dedicated. In the course of writing the book and getting involved in tortoise research with my students, I got to know some of these individuals, and some of them are absolutely amazing people in the host country where tortoises live and also in the Western world. Peter Pritchard is one example of a man who's dedicated his life to the study and also the conservation of all sorts of turtles and tortoises, from sea turtles to tortoises. And, you know, we need people like that because it really doesn't take that much money and effort to get tortoises from the brink of extinction back to a place where they're at least in captivity in a stable situation, and then we can hope to preserve the habitat for some future reintroduction.
You primarily are known for your studies with primates, and so are there any similarities between primates and tortoises?
Well, I mean, obviously they're very different in the sense that Primates are big-brained and mammals and quite different from a slow-moving, cold-blooded, and small-brained reptile. But there are interesting parallels that came out to me in the course of getting involved in the tortoise world, which is the fact that these are also very slow-growing, slow-living animals, just as we are. Long lifespans, their whole program in life is not to crank out a whole bunch of babies and do it quickly and then die at a young age, the way that, say, a mouse or a rat would. Their program in life is to live a long time and produce eggs every year, knowing that most of those eggs will be destroyed or their hatchlings destroyed, but a few will survive. And that's really kind of the ancestral biological pattern for people as well.
Okay, and there's this shocking, surprising story in the book about gopher tortoises being buried alive by Walmart construction. Can you talk about that story?
Yes. In the United States, where you would think we would have more resources, more capability, and more wealth than anyone else in the world so that we would protect our tortoises, we don't always do a great job of that. A lot of people are working on these problems in the American Southwest and also in the American Southeast. Walmart had a long series of lawsuits and negotiations in which they would want to buy massive tracts of land in places like Florida. And then if there were tortoise burrows on that land, they essentially paid the state for the right to then just entomb the tortoises, to simply fill the burrows in, build their parking lots over the tortoise burrows, and then compensate the state in an effort to purchase land that could be protected elsewhere. And so that is more or less ceased, but that's something that Walmart and other big companies were doing for a long time. And it's the whole issue of seeing wildlife as a completely disposable commodity.
In the chapter about eating tortoises, Stanford tells a story about a trio of gibbons in a bamboo-filled forest in East Asia. Hunters from a nearby village encounter the unlucky parents and their baby in the treetops. Tom Williams reads what happens next.
A blast shatters the calm morning. As the male gibbon watches helplessly, his mate drops from her branch. She's lost from sight in the leafy canopy, only the cracking of branches tracing her plummet to the forest floor far below. 1,000 birds and insects fall silent for a moment, then resume their day. The female hits the leaf-covered ground hard. She bounces once and flops over dead in a small pool of blood. A hunter walks slowly to her, kneels down, and flips her body over to find the infant huddled to her chest, trembling but alive. He pulls the baby off its mother and holds it up to the sun, where it whimpers and struggles to free itself. The hunter slings the mother over his shoulder and stuffs the baby into a bag hung over his arm. He knows that city people will pay good money for a baby gibbon as a pet. It will entertain some family's children for a year or two, and the mother will go into the cookpot. As he wipes the blood from his hands, his eyes catch something in the leaf litter. He leans over and picks up the tortoise. He has vivid memories of his father bringing large tortoises home to their village, where they would butcher them and eat the sweet meat. The empty shell would become a baby's bathtub or a serving bowl. In those days, they were common. He would find them close to the village and play with them until they were killed and served for dinner. These days, they're worth more sold to the local wild animal dealer. Wealthy foreigners, apparently with no concept of money or limits on throwing it away, will pay well for the creature in his hands. But he will keep this one for a family feast, or perhaps eat some, and then sell the rest to one of his neighbors. He cradles the tortoise under his arm, like a big loaf of bread, and heads in the direction of his village. A gibbon and a tortoise for the pot, plus a baby gibbon for the animal dealers, make this a lucky day for him.
That was Tom Williams reading an excerpt from Stanford's book, The Last Tortoise. Stanford says a Galapagos tortoise called Lonesome George is the icon of extinction. At somewhere around 60 to 90 years of age, he is an old man in human years. But in turtle time, he is still in his prime of life.
Lonesome George is probably the most famous, extremely rare animal on Earth. He is the last remaining individual of a population or perhaps a species of giant tortoises in the Galapagos found on Tinta Island. He was found in the 1970s wandering alone on this island and is the last remaining individual from that island, the others having been removed during the past century and a half by the whaling ships and other ships that stopped in the Galapagos. And a great deal of time and energy and effort has been spent trying to find a mate for George, who lives at the Darwin Research Station in the Galapagos Islands today. And there have been some recent successes, genetic studies, showing that there may be appropriate mates for George among females who are actually living on other islands in the Galapagos, but who are genetically very, very similar to him.
So far, all of the eggs laid by his female companions have been unviable. Therefore, the reproductive quest continues. We wish Lonesome George the best of luck, and we will continue to follow his progress towards producing offspring. China and other countries in Asia are easily blamed for exploiting the tortoise. However, Stanford notes in his book it is a luxury to protect them, and societies such as North America, who are no longer in survival mode, can afford to conserve wildlife.
The difficult issue with wildlife conservation is always that we're coming from affluent Western countries, and we're trying to essentially politely tell other nations that are in a much earlier stage of their economic development what to do with their land and their wildlife. We're basically saying, look, don't make some of the same mistakes that we made. And that's kind of a tough sell because it does smack of colonialism. But I personally think that the best thing you can do is train students in those countries and train conservationists and just people to appreciate and to learn to sustainably use their land and their wildlife so that they, who are obviously a part of that culture, which we are not, can then pass those values on to others. And that works. We've shown many times that can work. In the case of tortoises, it's difficult because many of the species are in imminent danger of extinction. So we don't really have the luxury of saying, oh, over the next few generations, we'll instill these cultural values. So working with these local countries and trying to persuade them to set aside land to try to change the culture of harvesting these animals for food or for just monetary exploitation for the pet trade, that's a big deal, and that's what a lot of conservationists are working on these days.
And are there products that conscientious consumers should avoid?
I think the main product the conscientious consumer can avoid is the tortoises themselves. Don't go into a pet store and buy a tortoise unless you're absolutely positive that animal was, one, bred in captivity, raised in captivity, not imported, in other words, and then also, two, not ill, not sick, because very frequently wild-caught animals are. That's the best thing you can do. And then, of course, there are lots of turtle and tortoise products out there. You can go on eBay today, I'm sure, and find many tortoise shell products, whether they're labeled accurately as such or not, and, of course, don't buy those.
And what is eating tortoises in Asia comparable to in North America? Is it scale? And what are some examples? Would the bison be an example here?
Well, I think that driving the bison to near extinction by the early 20th century is probably not too different from what's happening to turtles and tortoises in Asia. The difference is that today we do have an army of conservationists who are out there trying to ensure that there are what we call assurance colonies of each species that are still being bred in captivity that might someday be able to be returned to the wild. But it's, you know, it's a difficult situation.
And how hard is it to catch a tortoise?
Well, having spent many years trying to chase chimpanzees and gorillas through forests of Africa, I can tell you it's a whole lot easier to follow a tortoise than it is to follow a chimpanzee, and something I can probably do until I'm about 90 years old. So the issue is finding them because, of course, they often are camouflaged. They look like rocks. They're very good at being secretive. So the big issue is finding the tortoise in the first place, and then after that you can usually we use a radio telemetry. We attach a tiny transmitter to its shell, and my students will study its movements through its habitat.
Tortoises are highly specialized animals. Their slow and unwavering evolutionary strategy has enabled them to survive for millions of years on planet Earth. Now their tranquil approach is doing the opposite and quickly leading to their demise.
Tortoises have adopted a particular way of life. Live long, lay a few eggs every year, be well protected against the environment with that wonderful shell. And that works. That's worked for hundreds of millions of years. Unfortunately, it doesn't work quite so well in the 21st century because local people find them, eat them, they can be collected and sent off into the pet trade, and of course they are crushed by the thousands under the tires of cars and trucks. So exactly the same devices that protected them for millions of years have kind of betrayed them today.
No matter what niche they fill in nature, nor what traits they have evolved, tortoises cannot seem to win the evolutionary race these days. One might suspect the unlikely speedy pancake tortoise from Africa could beat the odds. Instead, they are in serious trouble because they do not resemble a typical tortoise.
Pancake tortoises are in trouble in East Africa because they are adorable little tortoises that stay very small. They're the only tortoise that has a leathery, soft shell. So because they're kind of bizarre and small, they're very popular in the pet trade. And they are exported in huge numbers, or have been over the years, from East African countries. There are quotas. Sometimes those quotas are violated. And people are willing to pay a lot of money for them. And then the other thing working against them is that female pancake tortoises only usually lay one or two eggs a year. So they have a very low reproductive rate, and then a lot of collecting going on in East Africa for the pet trade, and that's a really lethal combination.
And the problem of the desert tortoise, you say, is the problem of wildlife everywhere. Can you explain?
Well, in our own country, we have desert tortoises in the U.S. Southwest, and you know we have a lot of people out there working to protect them. But they're endangered by things that you might not expect. So as human populations encroach on the desert, we bring with us, for instance, our trash dumps, our garbage dumps, and then coyotes and ravens are attracted to those. Those coyotes and ravens become huge predators on baby tortoises, and they're actually maybe the main source of mortality these days for baby desert tortoises in the U.S. Southwest. So all of these unintentional indirect effects that come as a result of human development.
And you say sustainable development is a buzzword. What's wrong with that?
Well, of course, we all want to support sustainable development. That's the notion that people in developing countries can economically develop while at the same time sensibly using the land and the resources around them so as not to exterminate all the wildlife and therefore not have it for harvesting themselves as well as destroy the wildlife. It's a little bit of a buzzword to me simply because there are plenty of studies showing that, you know, as people develop and have the money to buy guns, they buy guns and then they decimate the wildlife. So we, of course, want to work with local communities and get them into a new place economically, which is better for their families, better for the health profile of the population, try to move them out of a place where they're simply exploiting all the wildlife and natural resources around them. But in the course of doing that, as people become more affluent, they sometimes use that affluence to buy weapons that they then use to destroy more wildlife.
You mentioned roadkill, and
right.
Can you talk about the role of roadkill in our modern ecosystem?
Roadkill is not a glamorous topic, of course, but it's actually a surprisingly an awful, devastating effect on wildlife of all sorts. In fact, if you go to some of the big safari parks in East Africa, there is an enormous sum of animals, even large animals, giraffes and zebra, that are dying every year because of long-distance truck traffic coming through on those highways that have been built through those safari parks. So, of course, tortoises are utterly vulnerable because when they're under a certain size, they're just rocks under the wheels of a truck. So anytime they cross the road, anywhere they're crossing the road, they're in big trouble.
What are solutions at the local level, grassroots efforts that, you know, people can do here in Utah?
Well, at the grassroots level, you know, of course, the one thing any consumer can do who wants to own a tortoise is not buy one that was taken out of the wild. And that's really not a difficult thing to do. You simply go to a breeder rather than going to a pet store. You can find breeders all over the place on the internet. You can be careful when you buy from a pet store what you're buying, making sure it's not been imported, making sure it's not diseased, because very often pet store turtles and tortoises are. And as a consumer, you can also be aware that there are conservation organizations out there. I like to promote the Turtle Survival Alliance, the TSA, which does a great job of channeling money to particularly students and conservationists in the host countries where these animals live, who then are working at the local level, grassroots projects with villagers and so forth, getting them to sustainably harvest these animals.
That was Craig Stanford, author of The Last Tortoise, A Tale of Extinction in Our Lifetime. For more information about the plight of the turtles and tortoises, visit turtlesurvival.org. And now our Postcards from Outer Space series with Wasatch Elementary third graders. This week, Dylan Carson presents his card from the biggest star in Taurus.
My name is Dylan Carson and I'm almost 9 years old and my subject is about Antares. Dear sister, I haven't seen you for a while. You know why? Because I'm in the biggest star in the world. Now, I'm going to teach you a little, sis. First, Antares is in the constellation of Scorpion. Second, Antares is much more bigger than the sun. Third, Antares is red, and I guess all the birds in the world will be to Antares like a piece of grain. Fourth, Antares is your name. Ha ha, love you, bro.
NASA aerospace engineer Jerry Delmans had this to say about Dylan's postcard, voiced by Brian Earle.
This young man is bound to be an engineer. I loved the way he enumerated his points and facts about Antares. Very logical presentation. A red giant sun is one that is nearing the end of its life. A very old star like Antares, our sun will someday evolve into a red giant before it burns out. This young man seems smart enough an engineer to maybe someday develop transportation that will allow humans to leave Earth before our sun becomes a red giant star like Antares.
And that is our show for today. Thanks for tuning in. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery. You can visit us online at sqradio.org. Thanks to Tom Williams and Brian Earle for lending their voices to this program. And special thanks to Kathy Ives for helping to make Science Questions a reality. Safe travels, best of luck, and we'll miss you. For Science Questions, I'm Sherry Quinn.
If you didn't bake a herring cake for the summer solstice this week, you're not too late. In Sweden, they actually celebrate on Friday after the solstice. UPR commentator Jennifer Pemberton spent time in Sweden, where she discovered a good herring cake is critical to enjoying the longest Friday night of the year.
I've been craving fish all week, and not just local pan-fried trout or a nice wild-caught Alaskan salmon fillet on the grill. I'm craving herring, and not just any old piece of herring, but pickled herring. 3 years ago, I wouldn't have been in the same room as a jar of pickled herring. Fish sticks were about the only fish product I would eat. And now I have a hankering for pickled fish that you just wouldn't believe. Living in Sweden did this to me. Anytime there was a holiday, pickled herring would go on sale for 5 kronor a jar, like 80 cents. And that's how we knew it was a holiday. My husband would load up on the stuff, which comes in about 10 flavors. Senapsil, which is in a sweet mustard sauce, is the gateway herring. This is the most palatable for newly initiated pickled fish eaters. Other flavors include onion, cream sauce, dill sauce, the ubiquitous lingonberry, or the super traditional marinade, which includes sandalwood shavings, which makes the fish taste a lot like an old cedar chest pulled up from the bottom of the sea. My husband would fill our Euro mini fridge with 5 kroner jars of herring while I figured out exactly what it was we were supposed to be celebrating. Herring went on sale for Christmas and for Easter, and for lesser holidays like Ascension Day and May Day. But the biggest day for herring, by far, is Midsummer. Midsummer is more than just the summer solstice. In fact, in Sweden, it isn't even celebrated on the actual solstice, but on the Friday/Saturday closest to the solstice. This isn't a school night kind of holiday. Midsummer is celebrated outdoors, with food and friends and family. Traditional foods include the year's first wild strawberries called smultron, which are as tiny as the tip of your little finger and grow all over the country. You string them on a shaft of wheat or rye like rubies and give them to your friends. There are fiery shots of schnapps, flavored with the most essential hints of old world flavors like blackcurrant or fennel or clove. And of course there's herring. My fondest midsummer memory is of a siltorta my friend made. A herring cake. That's right. I went from eating fish sticks to pickled herring for dessert in about 6 months. The cake had a moist rye crust like a sour graham cracker and was filled with pickled herring and gelatin so it set up nice and firm. It was frosted with sour cream and sprinkled with finely chopped chives. It was totally confusing to my senses, but it was exactly right for the occasion. The smell of the sea, the loud toasts to health and friendship, the magical twilight from a sun that never truly set, and the proverbial Midsummer Night's Dream that comes from cutting wildflowers and placing them under your pillow, hoping for a glimpse of your romantic future. This is if you manage to go to sleep at all that night. The idea is to strive for an endless summer night. So yeah, there is nothing not to love about midsummer, and the good thing is that the summer solstice falls on the same day every year around the world, so there's no excuse not to celebrate wherever you happen to be. As far as the herring goes, it's possible to find creamed herring in most U.S. supermarkets, which is mild enough to get you started. Just think, by next year you could be like me and my husband, who have been known to drive 3 hours to the closest IKEA to pick up some herring and dill sauce. We still use it to mark important milestones in our lives, like getting a new job or a PhD position. Our firstborn will be lucky to not be named herring. I will post my best translation of a Swedish herring cake recipe at upr.org if you're feeling adventurous. For Utah Public Radio, this is Jennifer Pemberton.
Hi, this is Blair Larson, host of Fresh Folk. On the show this week, I feature the latest album from the fabulous songwriter, Daryl Scott, and the triumphant new release from Gretchen Peters. I'll also play songs from new discs by Crabtree and Mills, Trevor Gordon Hall, and Ally McLeod, among other talented artists. Join me this Saturday at 8 p.m. for Fresh Folk on Utah Public Radio.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.